Hello, everyone. Happy New Year. Happy 2024. I'm Rita McGrath. You probably knew that if you are coming here today. Welcome to the first Friday Fireside Chat of the new year. So I'm really delighted to be here with you. A couple of housekeeping things. Just do remember that this is being recorded, so don't say anything you don't want your great Aunt Nellie finding out about. For those of you who enjoy the conversation, feel free to spread the word. It'll be up on YouTube and in other places in a few days, so you can catch up with us then. And it's also available as in podcast form. So those of you who don't want to sit through watching a video but would like to take us with you on your next run, jog, household chores, whatever you do, you're welcome to do that. So my guest today is Matt Abrahams, author of a terrific book, which I can highly recommend. It's called Think Faster, Talk Smarter. He's also the host of the Think Fast, Talk Smart podcast, which has a lot of these common ideas there. And the theme of the book is how to speak successfully when you're put on the spot. And I was so delighted that he agreed to join us because I think this is a really underrated set of skills that, you know, if you're prepared to put in the work and do the practice, it can really make a breakthrough difference. So thank you so much, Matt, for joining us.
I am thrilled to be here with you, Rita. Thank you.
So let's talk about, you've been a longtime fixture at Stanford. So let's talk a little bit about how this book came to be, because if I read your acknowledgments, it took a little persuasion.
It did. I think you just called me old, but no, I've been at
Stanford. No, I did not do that.
I've been at Stanford for a number of years now and enjoy teaching at the business school. So the book is actually built out of a need of our Stanford MBA students. So many years ago, the deans at the business school came to me and they said, we have a problem. Our incredibly bright students are struggling with the dreaded cold call. You know the cold call as well as I do, where the professor says, hey, what do you think? And our students were really struggling responding, even though they knew the answer. And so they came to me as the communication guy. I teach strategic communication, and said, can you help? And I did a deep dive into various fields, psychology, anthropology, communication, neuroscience, and even improvisation. And as a result, crafted a methodology that now all of our Stanford MBAs have the chance to take within their first 3 weeks on campus. And we find that they feel more comfortable and confident speaking in the moment. And the faculty feel like the dialogue and engagement has improved. And it turns out that this methodology doesn't just help students, it helps all of us, because most of our communication, if you think about it, is spontaneous. It happens in the moment. It's not the planned presentation, the meeting with agenda. It's the answering questions, giving feedback, making small talk. And that's really what we're trying to help with here.
I love that. And, you know, one of the things that I find so compelling about the book is the practicality of it. I mean, you know, the way you've got it structured is you've got the standard classic business book chapter structure and everything, but you've also got try this, you've got stories, it's full of acronyms that are easy to remember. So really, I can see how it would be super helpful to people just building up their confidence. So let's start with your six building blocks, I'll call them, or six steps.
Sure.
And maybe walk us through those so that we get a sense of how you would put them to work in a practical situation.
Well, thank you. And the whole methodology is rather straightforward, and you can take part in any step that you wish. It's really divided into two categories. The first is mindset. And the first four steps are around how do we adjust our mindset to help us be prepared to speak spontaneously, which is a counterintuitive notion, but one that makes sense if you think beyond just communication. If you've ever done a sport, you know you do a lot of training and preparation. So in the moment when you're being spontaneous playing your sport, you can respond. So the first four steps are on mindset, and the second two steps are around messaging itself. So we start by having to manage anxiety. When it comes to communication, one of the biggest challenges is the anxiety that many of us feel, both planned and spontaneous. The second step is a mindset shift away from trying to be right and perfect, and instead focus on actually connecting and being present with your audience, which leads to the third step, which is all about seeing these as opportunities. Many of us, when we're in the moment asked to spontaneously speak, feel very threatened and challenged by that, instead of seeing it as an opportunity to extend, expand, and connect. And then the final step in the mindset package is really listening. And again, this sounds counterintuitive. We're talking about communicating and speaking, but listening is critical so that you respond appropriately. So those are the mindset steps: managing anxiety, thinking about connection over perfection, seeing it as opportunities, and listening. And then we actually have to speak or communicate. And that's where the messaging comes in. So we have to use structure. Listing information is not a good way to get information across. And then finally, we have to be focused. Many of us, when we speak in the moment, say more than we need to. So taken together, those are the six steps. And as you mentioned in the book and in the work I do, I try to make it very accessible with lots of activities so people feel like they're making progress and they see that they're improving as they go.
I love that. So tell us the onion story. I thought that was a great story.
Yeah, well, thank you for bringing me back a little post-traumatic stress here. So I was interviewing for a job. So when I left academia, I got my graduate degree. I had some loans to pay. And I've always been a very applied person. I believe in theory. I think theory and strategy are very important, but I believe applying it is really critical. So I went to work. And I worked in high tech for over a decade. And for one of the interviews I had for a company I was very excited to work for, it was actually the very first B2B company. I made it through all the gauntlet, and I was at the final interview stage meeting with the CEO. And I walk into the room, and he was there ahead of time, which really freaked me out because usually you end up waiting for the executives. And the very first question he asked me, he said, "If you were an onion, and I peeled back the first three layers, what would I find?" And Rita, I panicked. What is this? What kind of question is this? And it was in that moment that I actually found that I applied some of the principles of the methodology that later was developed. I said, okay, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to commit. Here's an opportunity to share something about myself. I took a deep breath, and the first thing that came to my mind that I committed to was onions make me cry. When I cook, and I love cooking, onions, I tear up. And I said that, and I related that to emotion. And I said, I'm somebody who brings my full self, my emotion to the work I do, the excitement, the concern, the worry. And it was a managerial position. So I talked about my past experience of building teams who bring their whole selves to work. And as I'm answering this, he just got a big smile on his face. And we ended up having a great talk about how to work, how to set the term psychological safety wasn't part of the vernacular then, but essentially we were talking about that. And I got the job, and it was a wonderful job, a great time. And he and I became friends, and we talked about that experience. And he shared with me that his whole goal was to put people on the spot to see how they responded, because we were doing something that had never been done before. And a lot of it was going to be on the spot, having to respond. And rather than give the trite response that many had said, like, oh, well, you'd find out I worked too hard or whatever, he was pleased that I put a stake in the sand and talked. And that's part of this whole process, is handle the emotions, the fear, and then commit to something and go for it. And in that case, I was successful.
I love that story. I thought it was a great, and one of the things I liked about the way you structured the book is a lot of the sections begin with sort of an intriguing opening. Like, here's this Paralympic athlete who, without any warning, gets put, you know, before the national stage, you know, and then you sort of break away from that story. So we're all kind of, what happened? You know, like, what happened? And you sort of bring in your points, and then you finish with what happened to her. And I thought it was so interesting on a bunch of different levels. But one of the things I thought was really intriguing was, so she prepared this, you know, teleprompter opening to this speech. So I guess the background is, it was a huge sporting event in Australia, right? And the Commonwealth Games, I believe.
Yes, exactly.
And so she's really nervous. She's being asked to pinch hit at the very last minute about sports she doesn't know anything about. And so she writes this teleprompter pitch, and her male colleague who's introducing her reads her pitch. So she's got like to make it up on her own, and then you bring in the story at the end. But you know, you kind of do this throughout the book, and as a writing device, I think that's fascinating in the sense of storytelling.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're talking about the situation that Annabelle Williams found herself in. She was a Paralympian, a gold medal swimmer for Australia, and she found herself, she commentates on swimming, her area of expertise. And as you know, with these big sports shows, they have anchors who sort of coordinate across all the sports. And one of the anchors got ill, and they asked her to step up and fill that role. And she found herself on national television in front of millions of people, literally with nothing to say. She was supposed to say something, it was scripted, and she was able to employ many of the techniques that we talk about in the book. Annabelle is a former student, a friend, and somebody who had the opportunity to practice in her life, not just through the things she and I worked on, these skills, and was able to manage a situation that I hope none of us ever experience.
It must have been super stressful. I know this is all you had to deal with was an onion, you know. So let's talk about small talk. I mean, one of the things that I would argue in a lot of the work that I do has to do with the innovation process. I've also recently gotten into doing a lot of work on how we can create, you know, advancement for underrepresented groups. And one of the things that I find is people get so, they're just anxious and upset and just not happy to be in networking situations. And yet we know, you know, so much of your success in life is explained by who you know, who knows of you, who knows what you know, and so forth. And so you got one of the other things I really like about the book is you got the structure in the front, which is the six principles you've talked about. But then you've got these specific situations, and small talk is one of them. So maybe give our listeners some suggestions on how they can, you know, make small talk fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And I am so impressed with the work you do, especially around bringing unrepresented or typically unrepresented voices to the table. So congratulations on that. It's so important. The second part of the book is really dedicated to applied spontaneous speaking. So there's six very common situations, everything from answering questions, giving feedback, apologizing, and as you mentioned, small talk. And I am on a personal mission to rebrand small talk. Many of us dread small talk. And I think actually big, really exciting things happen during small talk. In fact, Rita, I'll ask you and all of your listeners and viewers to think about some of your closest friends. How did you get to know them? How did it originally start? My hunch is small talk was involved. And yet we tend not to think about that when we go to a social event or a work mixer. We don't remember that, hey, a lot of good things happen. So we all need to remind ourselves that big things can happen during small talk. One of the biggest challenges for small talk is that we put a lot of pressure on ourselves to be amazingly interesting and engaging. And on my podcast, Think Fast, Talk Smart, I get to interview amazing people. Yourself, you would be a wonderful guest, Rita. And I interviewed a woman named Rachel Greenwald, and she is a professional matchmaker as well as an academic. Talk about an interesting background. And she shared something with me that really just totally switched the way I personally see small talk, and I think all of us should look at it. And essentially, she says the goal of small talk is not to be interesting, but rather interested. So it's about being interested, not interesting, which means curiosity is the key. So rather than seeing it as a tennis match where I've got to serve my amazing insight or ideas across the net and ace it, rather we should look at it as that game of hacky sack, you know, where there's that little beanbag and you're tossing it back and forth with your foot. And the whole goal is to keep the ball in the air. So the best way to do that is to pass it to somebody else and make it easy for them. So it's about asking questions. It's about observing what's happening in the environment and commenting on that. And when you do that, two things happen. One, you take the pressure off yourself and you make it easier for the other person to join in. So that mindset shift of being interested versus interesting is critical to it. The second part, the second challenging part is how do you start these things and how do you get out of them? So again, observation, questions, that's the best way to start. Getting out of small talk. Many of us dread getting into it because we don't know how to get out of it. And we rely on our biology. We say things like, oh, I'm thirsty, I'm hungry, I have to go to the bathroom. Rachel provided another wonderful tool. She calls it the white flag approach. And not because white flag, I surrender, but in auto racing, the white flag signals the last lap. So when you want to end a small talk conversation, signal that. Simply say, I'd like to go over there and talk to some people, but before I do, I'm really curious about, or I'd love to talk just a little bit more about. So you signal you want to leave, so it's not surprising. You give the other person time to prepare to leave as well, but then you bring up one more topic. And then at the end of that conversation's part, you simply say, thank you. I'm now going to go chat over there. It is delightful to end conversations and small talk that way. Ever since I learned that, I've been doing it and it helps so much. So let's see small talk for what it is, big opportunity, be interested, not interesting, and we can really change that whole dynamic.
And I loved that example of getting out of it. I'm going to put that to work myself because that is a real challenge. You know, you're in a conversation and you know, you're here to network and someone's taken up 15 minutes of, you know, an hour and a half networking session and you know you should go meet other people. But sort of how do you extricate yourself? It's not always easy.
Absolutely. No, it's right. And we end up worrying about it. So we're actually not engaging fully with the person we're communicating with, which then degrades the experience. So if you know you have a tool that you can rely on to get out, then you can be fully engaged in the conversation.
And also there's no harm in saying, you know, I need to do something else. Right. And, you know, the other person's probably feeling the same way. I think we forget that, too.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And so being comfortable saying that, I think, is really important.
Yeah. And somewhere in the book, you make the point, which I think is really worth repeating, is that we all think the world is a lot more interested in us than the world actually is.
So I know. Isn't that a shame?
But, you know, I think one of the great anxiety reducers is if you realize that, you know, most people have their minds on something else, they're not actually that focused on you. So,
yeah, in psychology, my native area of study, there's this notion of the spotlight effect. We all feel like we're walking around with a spotlight shining on us and everybody is fixated on us. And the reality is everybody else is walking around thinking they have their own spotlight. So nobody's really paying as much attention to you as you wish. And the corollary to that is most people in most interactions with us want us to succeed. They want to get value from the interaction. We walk around thinking that we've got, you know, the America, you've got talent judges are judging everything we say. And that's not true. People want to hear from us and they want to see and learn from us. And so when we realize that, it can take a lot of pressure off of us.
One of the things that I really appreciated about the book was the chapter on structure. Mm-hmm. And I thought this was such a nice connection to storytelling. And you give a list in the book of specific structures. So problem, solution, benefit, past, present, future, comparison, contrast, conclusion. And then your favorite one, which I understand, is what, so what, now what? And one of the things you talk about in the book is having your students ask you a question about some topic randomly chosen. And you actually use one of those structures to answer the question in a vaguely coherent way. I think that's very brave.
Well, thank you. It's a lot of fun, actually. So, and in fact, you know, if you can put me to the test and see if I can think fast, talk smart, and you can give me a topic. But these questions are essentially like that. But the value of structure is critical. Many of us, when we are put on the spot, simply list and itemize the first things that come to our mind. And the reality is our brains are not wired for lists. In fact, Rita, think about if you had to go to the grocery store, how many items can you hold in your mind before you actually have to write them down and create a shopping list? If you're like me, it's like four or five, and then I need to go to the list because I'll forget something. Our brains are not wired for lists. So a structure is nothing more than a logical connection of ideas, a beginning, a middle, and an end. Stories are structured. And you itemize several of the structures that can be really powerful. The one most people are most familiar with, and I know you do work on entrepreneurship, I do work on entrepreneurship, anybody who's ever pitched or seen an advertisement is familiar with problem, solution, benefit. Here's an issue, a challenge, a problem. Here's how I solve it, or our product or offering solves it. And then here's the benefit of adopting our offering. So structure is just a way of connecting ideas together, but it has so much benefit. First, it helps us have a place to start. So if you ask me a question, I know I'm going to answer the question, I'm going to give you an example, and I'm going to explain how it's relevant. That's the structure I teach called ADD, answer, detailed example, describe the relevance. So when you ask me a question, I don't panic and say, how am I going to answer it? I know. All I have to do then is insert the content into the structure. So it makes my life easier. It makes your life as a listener easier because we digest packaged information much better than lists. So structure is really key. And the key part is to have structures in your toolkit, practice those structures so that you can then deploy them as needed. And in so doing, it builds confidence, builds concision, and it actually helps you achieve your communication goals.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really valuable. And you can remember these things pretty easily. And in the book, you've got some great structures itself, you know, with chapter summaries and everything. So for those of you who might just be joining us, my guest is Matt Abrahams. He is the author of this great new book, Think Faster, Talk Smarter. He also has a podcast, Think Fast, Talk Smart.
I'm not very creative with names, Rita.
Well, you know, it's easy to remember, right? Right. we're chatting today about some of his thoughts on how you can get better at spontaneous communication, which is really one of the paths to success in life, right? And if you think of the great sort of leaders, right, the people who've really made us take actions we wouldn't have taken otherwise, or persuaded us to do something we wouldn't have thought of. They're really great communicators. I mean, I've always thought that was one of the things that really set them apart from people who are, you know, technically very competent, but just unable to persuade and inspire other people. So another situation you talk about is pitches. Mm. So how do you design the perfect pitch?
Pitching is something we find ourselves doing all the time. It's not just to sell services and products. You know, we have to pitch our ideas. We have to pitch ourselves. So there are lots of ways to pitch. I have a structure that I think is really effective for in the moment, really quick pitching. So the literal elevator pitch, where you and I enter the elevator on the ground floor and we're going to the third floor. How do I pitch? And it's four sentence starters. So you just finish these sentences. And so let me introduce them to you. And then Rita, why don't you give me a product, a service, or something that you'd like me to pitch that I don't, this is going to be totally spontaneous. And I'll use the structure to help people see how it works. So four sentence starters are, what if you could, so that, for example, and that's not all. So what if you could, so that, for example, and that's not all. So the what if you could is the hook. It gets people involved. It gets them seeing how this is relevant. And then the so that makes it very practical. So here's the benefit. So you get people hooked with what's possible. You give them the benefit. And then you make a concrete example that people can relate to. And then you expand and extend, because most of us, when we pitch our ideas, are pitching something narrow, but that narrow service, product, offering, ourselves, has other potential. So these four sentence starters set you up for success. So let's see if I can think fast and talk smart.
Okay.
You have a particular service, idea, product. Why don't you share that with, just give me a topic and I'll try to pitch it in this structure. Let's see.
I love this.
We're flying without a net here, folks.
This is fun. So I have this great idea for a robotic dog walking service.
What if you could make sure that your pet is well exercised and has the opportunity to experience nature so that it is healthy and you have extra time to do the things you need? For example, imagine every morning at 6 a.m., your auto dog walker takes your dog, leashes it up, walks it around the block, and returns it by 6:20 so that your dog is well exercised and ready for its breakfast. And that's not all. this technique, this tool can allow you to connect with other neighbors and friends who have a similar device so that you can actually not only help your dog be more social, but yourself as well.
Bravo. That was great.
Well, thank you. And sure, certainly it could be a better pitch. But the point is, what I hope people take away from that is, I didn't know you were going to talk about robotic dog walking. In fact, I would have never thought about robotic dog walking. But in that moment, I didn't panic. I didn't say, oh my goodness, what am I going to say? I knew what I was going to say. All I had to do is say, what if you could? Well, if I had a robotic dog walker, what if you could? And so by simply finishing those the structure out, it allowed me to put something together. Now, I can use that, reflect on it, and then have a planned pitch that would certainly be more detailed and better, but it gets me through that moment. So thank you for indulging me, and let's collaborate and patent a robotic dog walker.
All right. That actually exists, by the way.
It does. Oh, my goodness. I know they're robotic vacuum cleaners. I didn't know they're robotic dog walkers. That's great.
I think it's one of the Japanese, of course, it would be a Japanese company that came up with right. this. So one of our regulars, Frank Kalberg, would like to know, what are some of the questions you ask in a small talk chat?
So I want people to avoid what I call the doom loops. So doom loops are standard heuristic sort of responses that we have in small talk, like, hi, how are you? And the other person says, fine, how are you? Well, now we're no better off than we were. Or, hey, what do you do? Oh, okay, what do you do? Right? These are loops that don't take us anywhere. So I like to highlight something in the environment. So I was a couple months ago at a social event. It was a mixer. And I walked in with somebody I did not know, and I looked around the room, and everybody had different shades of blue shirts on. It wasn't coordinated, just lots of people wearing different shades of blue, like you and I are wearing similar color purple. And I just turned to the person.
That was the way to start the year.
Yeah, I turned to the person. I said, I must have missed the memo about wearing blue. And the person looked at me. He wasn't wearing blue, nor was I. And we laughed and we struck up a great conversation just by observing something in the room. Another great thing to do is to connect on a shared experience. Many times at small talk situations, there's a shared experience. Maybe you're coming at a conference where there was a keynote or there was a theme. Maybe it was a celebratory event, a wedding, a quinceañera, something of that nature. So there are things you can comment on that happened in the shared experience to get it started. And so by focusing on the environment, focusing on shared experience, asking questions, making observations, you can get the ball rolling. It doesn't take much.
And one of the things I always encourage people who are nervous about networking is, don't think of it as networking as self-promotion, right? So let's say you want to learn, robotic dog walking. You want to be the world's leading expert on robotic dog walking. Well, find somebody in the room, and very often you'll know kind of vaguely who's there before you enter into a small talk situation, and strike up a conversation with them and say, hey, I've got this thing I'm working on for, creating better man-machine interactions, man-pet interactions by introducing robots. And I'm told you're doing some work on, artificial intelligence. Let's have a conversation about that. And, focusing, and I think your advice from your colleague is brilliant, right? It's really be interested, right? That idea that I'm here to learn from you, and I'd love to understand better this universe. And what I find that helps people do is, it really takes the anxiety off of this. I need to be a self-promoter. I need to be putting myself out there. Now, that being said, yes, another mistake that I see people making is this sort of good work speaks for itself. And I see that a lot with the work that I'm doing with underrepresented groups, in that they don't do any self-promotion. And I'm not saying you have to do it in a sleazy way, but, people are busy and distracted and they're not paying attention. And so you do need to figure out a way to get your message out, but it doesn't have to be sleazy self-promotion. You can add value to both parties, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, prior to us starting, you and I asked you to help. I was very direct in that too. And we all have to be comfortable asking for what we need and sharing, but doing so not in a, I'm a salesperson sort of way, but demonstrating why what it is you're asking for is valuable. And I want to highlight two things you said. First, you said before you enter into a small talk situation, you know who's in the room. there's a lot of pre-work we can do to help our spontaneous communication. So if I'm giving a presentation or I'm speaking up in a meeting, there's a good chance people might ask me questions. I can pre-think about some of those. Not that I'm memorizing or struck, you know, word for word coming up with what I'm going to say, but I can think about that. Small talk, I can think about who's going to be in the room. Similarly, I could think about what are some things that I might want to get out of this conversation or in this work. And we can think about ways in which we can talk about it. So I think there's some value in stockpiling. I like to look at it this way. I'm not a very good cook, but I like to cook and I like to eat. So I follow recipes. Well, how does a recipe work? You have a structure and you prepare ingredients in advance. You go shopping, you chop, you saute. You can do the same thing in your spontaneous speaking, especially small talk. I can think about, it's important for me to bring up this topic. Here's one way of sharing it. Not again that it's scripted, but I go in with some intention to these interactions. So I really wanted to highlight those two pieces, that we can accomplish goals in our spontaneous speaking, in our small talk, without sounding self-promoting or sleazy, by thinking through what's important. What are the things I'd like to talk about? And a key bit of advice is try to show, not tell. When we tell, we sound self-promoting. When we show, so I could say I'm the best salesperson ever, or I could tell you a story about a time I closed a deal that was really challenging. In the latter, I'm showing you, and it doesn't sound braggadocious or self-centered in doing that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think another thing that people are sort of shy about is sharing those success moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of us feel very uncomfortable talking about our successes or talking about ourselves and our traits. And it can be uncomfortable for sure, but it's also a way that we educate others and provide opportunities for ourselves. So again, what I recommend everybody when they're going for a job interview, and I think this applies beyond interviewing, think about some key attributes or themes that you want to get across, and then think about examples that you can use to support those themes. So it might be stories you tell, might be testimonials, might be awards or recognitions you've received. And stockpile those, not in an itemized way that in an interaction, my goal is to get through all of these. It's if something comes up related to that theme, I am now prepared to begin to discuss it. Again, it's like an athlete. Athletes will practice for certain situations that they will encounter in their sport. Not that that situation is going to arise every time they play, but because they've practiced it, because they've thought about it, when it does occur, they're ready to go. So if you do have something you want to get across, do some pre-work. And when the opportunity comes up, jump on it.
Well, this is something I think we don't take seriously enough, which is the preparation. So there was a very famous story about, who's the world-class swimmer, right? Michael Phelps.
Michael Phelps, yeah.
Who, I guess in one of his competitions, all the lights went out and all the, you know, everything just went to a complete stop. And yet he was able to finish the race. And I think he won a gold medal. And afterwards, people asked him, well, how did you do that? I mean, it's such a difficult and an unexpected situation. And he said, oh, because my coach put me through everything. I had to learn to do that in practice. He made me, you know, like half the water would be missing, the lights would go out. He made me practice all these different situations. Not that anybody expected that to happen, but that, you know, if it did, you kind of had muscle memory. You kind of were already in that moment and ready to go. So one of the things I didn't want to leave out at all is your section on feedback, because, you know, we've all been trained in the classic feedback sandwich, right? And it just, I don't find it very helpful. And again, in a lot of this work that I'm doing with underrepresented groups, the research shows that they typically get less feedback and they get less specific feedback and they get less developmentally useful feedback. So maybe to walk us through that.
Well, to me, feedback is critical, and I am a friend of and a huge fan of Kim Scott and the notion of radical candor. It turns out Kim's actually a neighbor, and we go on walks together. This notion of feedback is really critical. To me, feedback is really it's an opportunity to problem solve. And when you envision feedback as an opportunity to problem solve, and I'm talking about constructive feedback, positive feedback is also very important. And in fact, one of the things we all have to think about is we must give feedback constantly, both positive and constructive, so that when we have something really important, really constructive to give, it's seen in the overall span of the feedback that I give. If we reserve feedback only for the most critical constructive times, it feels very different than when it's just but one bit of feedback in a stream of more feedback. So that's really important. And it's an opportunity to problem solve. And when you think of it that way, what that means is you want to invite the other person to coordinate and collaborate with you in solving the problem. So it's not me coming in and saying, you need to, it's us together working on that. Now, certainly there are situations where you need to put a stop to something. Somebody has done something offensive or inappropriate. That's not an opportunity to problem solve. That's an opportunity to stop. But most of the feedback we're giving is an opportunity to problem solve. So we have to think about what is our clear goal. We have to have a clear goal, and it has to be very specific, something that's actionable. And I have a structure I presented in the book. It's called the 4 I structure. One, each step starts with the letter I, but also 4 I's like glasses. It helps you see things better. So the first of the 4 I's is information. You have to set expectations about what it is you're speaking on. So this is objective information. This is now the third time you've been late for a meeting. That's objective. Anybody with a watch could see that's true. The second step is impact. What is the impact on you, the feedback giver, or others? So it's not the impact on the person who's doing the being late. It's on you. So I might say, I feel you're not prioritizing this project to the level the rest of us are. That's the impact. It's a differential prioritization. The third step is the invitation. And the invitation can be a declarative sentence or a question. I could say, next time I need you to be at our meeting 5 minutes early. That's a declarative sentence. Or I could make it a question. What can we do to help make sure you show up on time and prepared? And then the final step is the consequences of what come as a result. So the implications. So they can be positive or negative. If you show up on time, we'll finish the project better or more quickly, and we'll get a more interesting project next. Or if you continue to show up late, we might have to remove you from the team. So the 4 steps are information. Here's the situation that we're commenting on. Impact. What does it mean for me, the person giving feedback? Invitation to actually adjust the behavior, and then talk about what the consequences are, the implications. And in so doing, you package it up so that it's not threatening, because if it's an invitation, if feedback is an invitation, defensiveness in the person you're giving it to is the enemy. We don't want them defensive. So by structuring it this way, we reduce defensiveness, we invite collaboration, which increases the likelihood that the change I'm looking for will take place. So the 4 I's is a very useful tool for packaging up feedback in the moment to help you get your point across.
I love that. But I think it's also what you said earlier deserves to be reinforced, which is, don't just make it negative. I'm on the not-for-profit board. And one of the things the board chair has done, which I think is super smart, is, you know, in a typical board meeting, you have the management there and the staff are sometimes there and everything. And then you have executive committee, which is when they all have to leave and it's just the board. And that's reserved typically for discussing something that is contentious or controversial or difficult. And our board chair said she's always got executive committee on the agenda, whether or not there's anything coming up. Because she said, if I don't do that, then anytime there is an executive committee meeting on the agenda, then everybody goes, ooh, what's wrong?
Right, exactly. Right. So you've got those, that has impact too.
Mm-hmm. It does. So one of the things that I'm sort of intrigued by is, I'm sure you've run across this, when people have really polarized opinions, I'm on one side of an issue and somebody else is on another side of an issue. And they're just, at least initially, not willing to even bother to communicate with each other. How do you break through some of that?
Yeah, well, in our society today, we have lots of challenges around differences of opinion and positions, etc. I am one who advises trying to find areas of commonality and agreement. I have a strong affiliation and affinity for improvisation. And in improv, there's a rule: yes And what yes and is really talking about is looking for connection, for accepting things. So when you and I might be debating some position or some belief that we have, I look to try to find some common ground to start there. And it could be, we both just care about this issue. You're on one extreme and I'm on the other. But the fact that we both care about this issue is a place that we can start. So it's about finding some common ground to start from. And just because I demonstrate understanding of your position does not mean I necessarily agree with it. Many of us come with this, we conflate understanding and agreement, and that they're not the same thing. I can fully appreciate your point of view and not agree with you, but I first have to listen. And one of the steps in my methodology is all about listening. We need to listen better. The reality is this, most of us don't listen well at all. We listen just to what we think we hear, and then we respond and rehearse and practice. In fact, I recently heard somebody say, the definition of listening for many of us is waiting our turn to speak, right? And that's not listening, right? So it starts by listening and then moving forward to find areas of commonality and then trying to express understanding. And then you can begin bridging and building towards agreement on something. So it is a process. But and the last thing I'll say about disagreement, and in fact, it comes from the world of negotiation. Many of us assume that the people we disagree with hold their values and views and beliefs as strongly as we do. And that's not true. Right. And when I confront you and I come full steam at you because I'm really passionate about it and you were only somewhat passionate about it, you feel threatened, so you become more strongly passionate. Let me give you a real simple example about how I deal with this in my relationship with my wife. When we have issues that look like disagreement, before we actually have a discussion, we will actually itemize or list for each other how important the issue is. Let's take something very mundane. We want to go out for dinner. And my wife says, I really want Italian food. And I say, I really want to do Chinese food. That could be conflict. We could have a disagreement here. But I say, you know, I'd really like Chinese food. On a scale of 1 to 10, it's a 4 for me. And my wife says, I really want Italian food. It's an 8. We don't have conflict. It's more important to her than it is to me. Many of us don't do that in our conversations and our disagreements and our negotiation. We assume the other person's position is as strongly held as ours. And sometimes it is, but many times it's not. And when we treat it as if it is, we actually create it being more important to them. So there's a lot we can do to bridge those gaps and actually come to agreement and understanding.
One of the things that I have learned in the science of storytelling is a huge mistake people make when they're trying to persuade others is they frame their argument in terms that resonate with them. So my colleague at Columbia, Jane Prager, teaches storytelling for us. And she uses the case of a fascinating example of a student class that was being asked to advocate for rights for LGBTQ people in upstate New York, where most of the residents were not particularly pro. You know, I think it was a case of it wasn't a strongly held belief. I mean, they weren't anti, but they weren't particularly, right. They didn't care, you know, about this issue. And they just were content to leave things as it was. So when the students first tried, they were framing the issue in terms that were quite relevant to them. Now these are, you know, Columbia, East Coast.
Yeah.
Liberal types. And so they were framing it in terms of, you know, personal freedom and the ability to express yourself and the ability to, you know, blah, blah, blah. Right. And when Jane worked with them, she said, you know, those terms are not going to be resonant to the people that you're trying to talk to. So let's look up what is resonant to them. And it was things like family values and the right to earn a living and the right to be part of a community and, you know, just a different framing. Right. And so what they ended up landing on was a campaign around the fact that there were quite a number of gay people in the community. And because it wasn't legal at the time, they would go to other states to get married. Now, that sounds sort of obvious. But when you then went back and said, well, wait a minute, that's a wedding, it's a venue, it's a wedding cake, it's all this revenue that's not coming back to our own community. It's being taken elsewhere because we're being so, you know, resistant to including these people in our community, and it ended up working. And so I think with a lot of issues that are like super contentious right now, we need to remember the people we need to persuade may have completely different starting points in terms of their values than we do. And I think that's a hugely valuable thing to remember.
Absolutely, I agree with that. Underlying what you're saying there, and it's so critical. And thank you for sharing that story. It really, really highlights the point. We all suffer when we communicate from the curse of knowledge and the curse of passion. We know a lot about what we're talking about, and we tend to be very passionate about our points of view and our beliefs. And that means that we tend to use language and jargon and acronyms and arguments that might not resonate with those that we're speaking with. And that actually distances us. The root of the word communication is to make common. And the curse of knowledge and the curse of passion pull us away from that. So the only antidote to the curse of knowledge and curse of passion is empathy. In the work I do and in the podcast I host, which is all about communication, the number one bit of advice across all of our guests is you have to know your audience. It's not about you, it's about them. It's about what they need. We have to be audience-centric. And your story is an exact example of that. When I understand what's important, relevant, and needed in my audience, forces me to adjust what I say and how I say it, so that it resonates and is salient with them. So thank you for bringing that point up. That is the foundational principle on which all communication is based, which is it's about the audience and we have to adjust our communication accordingly.
I didn't know it was based on to make common. That's really
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The root of the word communication is based on this notion of making common.
So in a potential conflict situation, a lot of listening, a lot of asking questions. And I think Adam Grant has done some work on this, which
Yeah.
is, it turns out the more that you ask people questions in an open way, not in a judgy way, but to say, well, tell me more about why you believe that. So what was the basis of that? And it turns out that one of the most successful ways to get people to actually be even open to reconsidering firmly held beliefs is that process of asking them to really be reflective of what they have said, the position they've staked out.
Yes, absolutely. And asking questions and being empathetic in your listening, again, it doesn't mean you agree, can not only help you foster that relationship, but it can help others really better reflect on and understand why they think what they think. So absolutely. Questions serve so many important purposes in how we relate. It's a way of engaging. It's a way of self-reflection and getting others to reflect. It's a way of demonstrating caring. So I'm a big fan of asking questions, as long as you said they're not judgy or accusing.
So I didn't want to leave out the material you have in the book. You've got two things. You've got throughout the whole book, you've got triads, which I love because it means without having to read the whole book, you've got like, here's a little nugget that you can actually practice with as you get better. And I think that's so useful for. But you also have games. So shout the wrong name. And the one I really like is I have a gift for you.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
So some techniques borrowed from improv.
Absolutely. As I said, I'm a big fan of improv, and I have been very fortunate in my life to have some amazing improv mentors, Patricia Ryan Matson, Dan Klein, Adam Tobin. These are all folks I have the pleasure of teaching with at Stanford, and they've taught me so much. Improv, many of us see improv as it's all about just being funny. And it's not. Improv is about being in the moment. It's about collaborating. It's about learning about yourself and others and connecting. And these silly, what seem like silly little improv games in the hands of an improv master are really insightful. So can we talk about Give a Gift, that game, a
Sure.
little bit and
Love
its value? And maybe you and I can even play it. So
it.
there's a
Oh,
game that I first learned from my colleague and friend Adam Tobin. It's called Give a Gift, and it's very simple. One person gives a gift to another, pantomimes giving a gift, and then the other person receives the gift, opens the imaginary gift and says the first thing that comes to their mind. Thank you for the whatever comes to their mind. And then the gift giver, upon hearing what they gave, immediately explains why they gave the gift. So you can see that there are two opportunities for spontaneity. The first thing that happens, though, when you play the game is you ask the person who is going to receive the gift, do you already know what's in the box? And the vast majority of people say, yes, I already know what's in the box. And then you have this discussion about stockpiling, heuristic planning, and all of this, because we want to win, we want to do it well. So I come up with, here's what's in the box. But in so doing, you limit yourself to what's possible. And that's part of spontaneous speaking, is if I go in saying, I am going to say this, it means I don't say all these other things. So it opens up a whole fantastic conversation about planning versus not planning. When do you plan? When don't you plan? When do you stockpile? When do you don't? And then the other thing that will happen, well, actually, let's play the game and I'll share the other thing. Are you willing to play the game?
Sure, absolutely. Okay. I'm always
going. How about I give you a gift, Rita, and then you're going to tell me what's in your box, the first thing that comes to your mind, and then I'm going to explain why I gave whatever you say. So I know we just finished the holiday season, Rita, but I've been saving this gift for you. So here it is. Here's a gift.
Thank you. What is it?
You tell me what's in the box.
Oh, I tell you what's in the box.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I thought you were going to tell me.
No, you tell me, and then I'm going to tell you why. Okay. I got it.
Let me do that again.
Yeah.
See that? Open it up. It's this book. It's this fantastic book on communication style that I've learned a lot from.
Well, you are already an expert communicator, but I thought you might want to have some new ideas around how to communicate spontaneously. That's why I got you the book. So do you see in that interaction, it's fun because you get to share something. The second big realization that comes from this game is how I, as the gift giver, feel when I hear what I gave you, because I don't know what I gave you. And
many that nuance.
Right. And when we play this game, many people say, I was really excited and focused. What did I give? What did I give? I want to know. And yet, when you find out you have to do Q&A or you know somebody's going to ask you for feedback, we don't see that as a gift that we're excited about. We actually feel that as a threat or a challenge, like, oh no, I have to answer questions or I better give really good feedback. So I try to help my students and the people who read the book realize that you can actually see answering questions, giving feedback as gifts, as opportunities, something you're excited about versus something that you dread or feel threatened by. So playing a simple little game like giving a gift actually opens up a whole lot of possibility for conversation, self-reflection, and invitations to change the way we approach our communication. So that's what I love about improv. And that's why in the book, there's several different improv games that people can play right away to have those experiences.
Can I give you a gift?
Say, well, yes, please. I'd love to have a gift. Yeah, let's play the other way around.
I've got a gift for you.
Let me open the gift. Thank you. I love getting gifts. Oh, my goodness. Thank you for the camera.
The camera. I thought you would really like a camera to start out the new year, because I think taking photographs and having visual images is such a nice complement to communication strategies. So I thought it would really be a great thing for you to have.
What not only a lovely gift you gave me, but what a lovely explanation. And do you see how that's fun, right? I mean, you had a big smile on your face. You didn't look nervous. You didn't look threatened. And wouldn't it be great if you brought that to all your communication?
I love that. I love that. So one of the other things I've been studying recently is based on some work by my friend Eric Johnson, who mm-hmm. studies choice architecture.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I think this idea, he wrote a fabulous book called The Elements of Choice. And one of the things he observes, and I think this sort of connects to your work, is that human beings over millennia, you know, have been trained to conserve energy in our brains. Mm-hmm. And so the way choices are presented to us makes such a big difference, because we'll take, you know, we're lazy. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, you know, in the past, there were very few calories to go around. And if you spent a lot of brain calories on things, you know, that was not good for you. but right. We've kind of evolved past that point. And so one of the things he points out is that because our brains are lazy, that if you make communication complicated or full of jargon or difficult to digest, we just kind of go, you know, and we just can't take it all in. So I think the two ideas really fit together very nicely. And so his work is really around how we architect the situation. And I think your work is really very complementary to what we do in the situation. So I think those two ideas fit together really nicely.
I love that. And decision science is something that I'm fascinated by. And you're right, how we frame our communication, the decisions we have to make, the choices, the negotiations really matters. And the part I think I bring to that is we can actually use frameworks in the communication we have to make it easier for people to digest. And that's what the whole structure and honing and making it relevant for your audience do. So I absolutely see the synergy you're talking about.
Yeah, and I love the sort of, you talk about focused communication.
I call it the F word of communication.
One of the other things I meant to mention this about your book is you have these kind of titles for your chapters that make you kind of go, what? Like the one on mediocrity, you know, maximize mediocrity.
I'm happy to share that. So you know, part of communication is cutting through the clutter and getting people's attention and engaging them. And if you can build curiosity, so when you hear maximize mediocrity, you're like, what? That doesn't make any sense. But it builds curiosity. I mean, you want to say, what does he mean by that? Or when I say the F word of communication, you immediately think, what is an academic talking about the F word, right? So it's the hook to pull people in, which is really about helping people focus their attention. Well, very quickly, maximizing mediocrity is really important. And it gets actually to the point you were just talking about, the cognitive bandwidth we have that evolution has provided us with. Many of us, when we communicate, we want to do it right. We want to be as perfect as we can. And I'm here to tell you, after decades of studying this, there is no right way to communicate. There are better ways and worse ways, but there is no one right way. If we are constantly judging and evaluating what we are saying, it means we have less cognitive bandwidth to actually focus on what we're saying. We actually have to focus on the audience and connecting, not how we're saying it and judging it. So I'm not saying never judge what you say. That's not what I'm saying, but turn that volume down. So if we encourage ourselves just to maximize mediocrity, just accomplish the communication task at hand, don't strive for greatness. By just maximizing mediocrity, you actually free up bandwidth to actually do it really, really well. So this notion of focus your effort on connection, not perfection, really makes a difference at a cognitive bandwidth level. So maximizing mediocrity is just a reminder, get the task done, focus on the audience, and you'll benefit, and they will too.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the focus thing is so important. And you talk about be precise, be relevant, be accessible, don't use a lot of jargon, and then be crisp, right? And I think the canonical example is Steve Jobs announcing the iPod, right? So, you know, and then many people doing that could have talked about the features and the this and that. And instead, he came up with this phrase, what is it? 1,000 songs in your pocket.
In your pocket. That's exactly right. And if you think about it, not only is it very clear and concise and visual, it also is relevant in solving the problem that people had. Because back in the day, we had hundreds and hundreds of CDs that we were carrying around, right? And so what was the problem? I want my music with me wherever I go. So in that example, it's clear, concise, visual, and relevant. And it, all of us can help focus our communication in that way.
For the kids listening, a CD was this brightly colored or basically coffee cup holder, you know, that you put that on your table.
The place you see them most now is people put them up in their gardens because they scare birds away. Those silvery circular things, they actually are what we used to listen to music on.
I know. I made a mistake and added up all the money that we'd spent on CDs over the years, and it was really depressing. So we're down to our last couple of minutes. Share with us how people learn more. Like, where do they, well, obviously buy the book. So just as a reminder, the book is Think Faster, Talk Smarter by Matt Abrahams, who credits being the first alphabet number, like AB, you know?
Yeah, so.
with getting him started on this whole path of communication because he called on a lot.
Exactly. I've been spontaneous speaking my whole life because I've always gone first with AB. In fact, at the business school at Stanford is the first time I am not first in a work setting. You might know Jennifer Ocker, one of my colleagues. Her name is AA, and it's the first time I haven't gone first. So the best way to stay in touch with me, and I would love to connect with everybody, mattabrahams.com. I have a whole bunch of resources. Please tune in if you like listening to Rita and her podcast. Think Fast, Talk Smart is all about communication skills. You can find us wherever you find your podcasts. And I'm a big user of LinkedIn, as I know you are, Rita, and I'd be honored to connect with folks listening in on LinkedIn as well.
That would be just great. Well, so what we'll do is there was a fairly active amount of chat that I couldn't keep track of as we were talking. But what I'll do is we'll capture that, we'll share it, and then maybe what we'll do is send out a little post conversation set of answers if there were things that were asked that we didn't get to. So that will be our follow-up. So welcome 2024, everybody. Thank you so much, Matt Abrahams. And as I like to always say, to be continued.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Rita. This was really fun, and happy 2024.
Happy 2024.